Gracias por descargar este podcast de Hey Festival. Para más información sobre nuestros festivales internacionales y sobre cómo acceder a nuestro archivo, por favor visite heyfestival.org. Gracias.
Here in South America, and we showed that film for many reasons. A, we wanted to bring him into this theatre with us all tonight, but also because we're lucky enough, and I'll introduce our speakers as they come round, and they're all going to say something before we talk among ourselves. But Alan Yentob, who's sitting next to me, actually made that film. Alan is and has been for years the creative director of the BBC. He's made films about all sorts of extraordinary people, but we were thrilled that he was able to bring this one to Colombia. Alan, you made one of the early films about him. It still feels like it was just yesterday when you watch it.
Yeah, no, it's true. And it was extraordinary, really, this moment, because it's a critical moment in Bowie's life, as you can see, because he created this character, Ziggy Stardust, and a whole host of other characters. And then in this famous moment at the Hammersmith Odeon, he killed off Ziggy Stardust, and Penny Baker was there to capture it. And when he was going to America on the Diamond Dogs tour, I had done very little at that time. He saw a short film I made, and he said he liked it, and he asked me if I'd like to come to New York to meet him. And I met him, and he said, would you like to make a film about me? And it was like that, and I said, yes. And then for the next 3 months, I followed him around America in the back of cars at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he was going through an incredibly difficult stage, a stage of transition, as you can see if you watch the film. In fact, you can watch the film because it's on YouTube, so you can go home and watch it. And it was a moment in which he himself was going through a difficult time. He was, you know, his diet was milk and cocaine, by and large. That was kind of what he was taking. And he was very, very honest. And in fact, the whole film was really about him, about the characters, about the songs, and about what I think is very important about Bowie, which is about the young people who he identified with and loved. And all those songs, I heard someone talking to you, Deborah, on the way about Life on Mars, which is such an amazing song. And all these songs, on Hunky Dory particularly, are about the imagination, about the life of the imagination. They're about young people, and about people who feel constrained and constricted in their lives, and then whether it's Space Oddity and Major Tom, or whether it's Changes, or whether it's Life on Mars, all these impossibilities, or Oh You Pretty Things. I mean, Somehow he had this incredible connection with those people, allowing them to escape into another world, Just as he was able to escape into other characters.
Yes. Jacko Solnick, sitting next to Alan, is a Colombian journalist and rock and roll writer who's put together many books of interviews with rock stars. Indeed, in one of the books that he collaborated with someone, it's the only interview, I think, that he gave in South America. Did he have a similar effect on young people that Alan is describing back in the early 70s?
Bueno, particularmente en Colombia, y eso es un caso muy especial, la música de David Bowie empezó a ser conocida a partir de los, podríamos decir, de 1983 en adelante, particularmente cuando se lanza el álbum Let's Dance, que tiene una importante rotación en el canal de videos MTV y una difusión importante justamente en las emisoras de música pop contemporáneas aquí en Colombia. En los años 70 la música de David Bowie llegaba a través de personas que viajaban a los Estados Unidos o a Inglaterra y traían alguno de los vinilos prensados y lo compartían entre círculos de amigos. Eso particularmente puedo decir que generó un interés, pero muy de nicho, no fue una cosa muy masiva, si se puede decir. El verdadero impacto de la música de David Bowie, particularmente en Colombia, se da a partir de 1983. Y como tú bien lo decías, Rosy, la única vez que un periodista colombiano tuvo una aproximación a David Bowie fue en 1993, cuando se presentó el álbum Black Tie, White Noise. David Bowie pasa de EMI Music a BMG y se logra esta entrevista que está publicada en el libro Rockestra.
But what was the impact of his music on other South American bands and on just on young people? Because it was so colossal certainly my life in London in the early 70s, in his androgyny, I mean, the things that Alan was talking about, the personality change. Was it similar here?
Especialmente puedo citar el caso de Argentina, que es muy interesante en el impacto que tuvo David Bowie. Argentina, para quienes conocen el mundo del rock en español, creo que la producción más interesante de rock en español que se ha hecho a lo largo del tiempo viene de Argentina, particularmente finales de los años 60, principios de los 70, con músicos como Luis Alberto Spinetta y su banda Pescado Rabioso, Manal, Almendra, Charly García con Sui Generis. La música de David Bowie, en el caso particular de Argentina, tampoco llegó, como tampoco llegó a Colombia, porque los vinilos no se prensaban en esos países. Fue hasta 1983 con el álbum Let's Dance, después de que termina la dictadura de Galtieri y el veto a la radiodifusión de música anglosajona termina con la dictadura, porque recuerden ustedes que cuando Argentina e Inglaterra entran en esta absurda guerra de las Malvinas, uno de los principales efectos fue la prohibición de la radiodifusión de música británica especialmente. Así que cuando finalmente la música de David Bowie empieza a llegar a Argentina, tiene un especial efecto en tres bandas fundamentales: Virus, que es una banda que no trascendió en toda América; Fricción, que es la única agrupación que ha hecho un cover de un tema de David Bowie en español; hablamos de Heroes, que en el año 87 Richard Coleman lo produjo con el nombre de Héroes, y particularmente en un músico que es muy conocido en Colombia, que fue muy querido por nosotros, hablo de Soda Stereo y Gustavo Cerati. Todo el concepto de imagen andrógina que venía desde Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane y posteriormente en Scary Monsters, creo que Scary Monsters es un disco fundamental. Y particularmente ese impacto que tiene la difusión del rock argentino a lo largo de todo el continente americano llega a Colombia a través de Soda Stereo, y en Colombia tiene un pequeño impacto en una agrupación que se llama Aterciopelados.
Oh, thank you, Jackie. Deborah, my next guest tonight, Deborah Levy, very well known and very wonderful novelist. You say, I mean, we've talked about that feeling that, especially coming out of the end of the 60s into the 70s, feminism, gay rights, that Bowie just articulated a lot of things for a lot of us. And you said particularly your first novel, Beautiful Mutants, was very influenced by him. Do you want to talk about that a bit more?
Yes, I mean, when Bowie died, it was as if my arm had fallen off. That's how it felt. He was so part of everything that made me a writer. In the 1970s in London, when I was 13, Bowie first came on the telly. There was a program called Top of the Pops where all these bands used to play, and the kids, especially if you lived like I did in West Finchley, which was a really boring suburb, and everyone called their dog. There were two names. One was Patch, one was Spot. And I remember Bowie coming on to sing Starman, and my brother and I had spilt some crisps on the floor, some potato chips, and my mother came back from work, and we had to clean it up. And at that time, Bowie came on, and she would murder us if we didn't do it. And we said, okay, you can kill us, because nothing was more important than what we were seeing there. And what I mean by that is that, in a way, Bowie told the truth. Despite the exuberance and the personas and the clothes and the makeup that we all copied for years and years, he told us there was a lot of anxiety about femininity and a lot of anxiety about masculinity. And these were performances that we were pinned to. You know, girls in the 70s felt very pinned down to one story. We were pinned to earth. And then the Starman came, and he messed it all up. Mm. And he told us that this was fluid. It wasn't something that we were stuck in. So he opened up an imaginative space that was there in all of us anyway. And so that was the beginning for me of my Bowie being my muse forever. And just one other thing. In his early days, when he, quite a lot has spoken about his mime. So he had learnt this from Lindsay Kemp. But Lindsay Kemp, who was at the time quite a famous American, I think, mime artist, was actually working from the French writer Jean Genet's incredible novel, Our Lady of the Flowers.
Jean Jennings.
Yeah. So it was literature, it was fashion, it was sexual politics, it was cultural identity, and Bowie was someone who your parents would never understand. You know, he was ours.
Yeah, that's very true. I also was always, I loved him because he was the first rock star that wasn't really overtly macho. And very, very, it seemed in a lot of ways, they were, you know, women were extremely subservient to that, those big 1960s rock and roll stars. Hanif, this morning, this is Hanif Qureshi, everybody, who I hope many of you came and heard this morning. He's one of our most important novelists, essayists, journalists, writers. And Hanif, this morning, sitting right here on this stage, gave a wonderful image of him being a young man dressing up in tinfoil and wearing Bowie makeup and painted nails, and I think you even said high heels, and trotting down Bromley High Street.
Very good in high heels, Rosie. They really suit me.
Well, I wasn't in any way questioning whether you looked good or not. I was more questioning why you were doing it and what your impact was, because you went on to work and collaborate with him. So you must have been it must have been amazing for you to come to meet someone who you had hero worshipped to the extent that you were up for dressing up in tinfoil and tiptoeing down the high street.
Well, I really identify with what Deborah said. You know, you're sitting in your front room at home and there are crisps over the floor. And actually what Alan said I thought was brilliant, because he came as a form of amazement to people that led small lives. And in the 60s and the 70s, apart from, you know, famous people in London, most of us were sitting in our front rooms watching Dad's Army. And it was a really small world. And we knew that there was a bigger world out there. And when Bowie sang, Oh, You Pretty Things, and told us to dress up and get out, it was really, really liberating. And I think what you say, actually, about the 60s and Led Zeppelin and The Who, particularly those heavy bands.
Well, and the Rolling Stones, incredibly tough.
Yeah. Funnily enough, though, Bowie was, you know, he was not effeminate in any way.
No.
And he was not gay in any way, actually. I've never met a more heterosexual man. He loved women. And he loved having sex with women. But he found a new way for pop to move forward. And he really understood that about pop, actually. I think he was one of the first pop stars to really understand about capitalism.
Go on, what do you mean?
Well, to use capitalism, to understand that you had to change. He really understood how to use publicity, mm-hmm. and the market.
And the way he invested early on, where he bought all the rights to his songs, he was very... But of course he had to go through a difficult period with the Freaks before he took a grip himself.
I went round to see Brian Eno a few months ago, and Brian Eno said that David Bowie had bought all the stuff that Brian Eno had thrown out, and that he'd bought it under another name. Because I said, did you go and see the exhibit? And Brian Eno said he didn't know that Bowie had kept all that stuff, and that he'd bought everything, he'd kept everything, he had warehouses.
That's so right. I was going to call the film I made The Collector before I started, because whether it's ideas or images or people or things, he was a collector.
Can I bring in Jamie here?
Yeah.
Jamie Bing runs Canongate Books, which is a fantastic publisher. He does wonderful books. I know you haven't published books about him, although you have a letter in one of your... I think you're going to. A letter in one of your wonderful letters. But you have been a huge fan all your life.
Yeah, and I'll come on to the kind of Bowie as a collector, because the only time I met David Bowie was in New York concerning a book that he wanted to put together, which has sadly not yet seen the light, but it was called Bowie Objects. And he, in a very interesting way, decided that if he was going to write his biography, which he kind of decided he was going to in a manner, in a fashion.
How long ago was this?
This was in November 2010. It was amazing when I look back on it that other publishers weren't all jumping over one another to publish this book. And Andrew Wiley, who's a literary agent based in New York, Andrew, he had on the Wiley stand at the Frankfurt Book Fair this little Jonathan Brambrook designed little dummy of this book called Bowie Objects. And actually, Andrew wasn't on the stand when I went and looked at it. I knew some of the other people who worked with quite well, so I managed to take a bunch of photographs of it, because you weren't meant to take any photos, you meant to just look at it. And in it, there were like 8 images that Bowie had picked from different parts of his life. And for each of the photographs, there was just a small caption, only like 50 to 100 words. One of them, it had the lyrics of Life on Mars, and he told a story about the park bench he'd written that on. Another one had this weird-looking synthesizer that Mark Bolan had given him, which was the machine that they used, the synthesizer, to create the effect of the rocket taking off in Space Oddity. One of my favorites was a tiny little Coke spoon, and the caption just said, "Found this in the pocket of a waistcoat jacket that I'd won on the that I'd worn on the Thin White Duke tour. That was in one pocket, and a unsmoked packet of Gitane were in the other. Small little spoon for putting small amounts of cocaine into my small little nostrils." And that was his caption. And I was just like, "Fuck, this is going to be an amazing book." Wow. And I got invited by. We offered on it. I said to Andrew, "We've got to publish this book." And I had a bunch of publishers who I was close to around the world who wanted to do it as well. He said, "Why don't you come and meet David?" So I went to New York. Never been more scared, excited, just generally kind of uncertain how I was going to be able to deal with this meeting. Because, I was born about a week after Space Oddity, as a week before Space Oddity was released. So, I was born in June 69. And Bowie didn't really make an impact on me until I was about 12 years old. And I love music, but most of the music I was listening to was stuff that, apart from crap pop music, was stuff that my parents were playing. I love the Beatles. And I think Bowie was the first artist, I think, of real quality who I kind of, if not discovered myself, because a friend gave Hunky Dory to me at school, he was the first one who I felt I had a real personal relationship with. And actually, that's just increased over the years. It hasn't reduced at all. And one of the joys for me of the last few years has been introducing my 6-year-old boy, Nathaniel, who I took to the Bowie show at the V&A. He almost learnt to count from Space Oddity, I feel, albeit backwards. And Nathaniel probably knows about 30 Bowie tracks, you know, by name. You know, if you play him Rock and Roll Suicide or Rebel Rebel or Starman, he immediately knows what it is. And that to me has been one of the greatest joys of my life, actually, is seeing my young 6-year-old son over the last 3 years kind of get as much out of Bowie. I wasn't even listening to Bowie at that age, and it makes me think that Bowie's going to continue to have a huge impact on many, many listeners all the world over for decades and decades to come.
What happened to the book there? Exactly.
Yeah, sorry, shit, I got distracted from that. So we left the meeting, we had this incredible meeting, and I brought a lot of books with me, and as has been widely known, particularly by those who knew him, but since he died, he was a massive reader, David Bowie, incredibly wide range of books he read, both, you know, of all types of books, but big, big reader of poetry and fiction and just serious, interesting writers from all around the world. So I brought him a lot of books with me, and he was happy to get those. And we had this great meeting with Coco, who I hadn't realized until Hanny pointed out that was Coco in the car in your film, Alan. So it was Andrew Wiley, me, Coco, and David in Andrew's offices. And we spoke for about an hour and a quarter. I left, meeting ended, and Andrew walked out with... Yes, she walked out with them first, then came back, and we had a brief chat. He said, "Spoke to David and Coco, you're definitely going to do the book." And I was like, oh my God, that's just like, I was beyond belief excitement. I'd flown in from London to New York just for this meeting. I was flying back like a day later. And then he called me about 2 weeks later and said, "Look, Dave really wants to go with you, but he thinks he should see one other publisher. I can't believe no other publisher had wanted to publish his books. Like, what the fuck were they all doing? I couldn't believe it. Anyway, I was like, that's my luck. But then he decided to see Penguin. So he saw Penguin. They had a meeting. We were then asked to put in our offers and our kind of vision for the book. We created a whole website in which we kind of came up with the design for the book and what we wanted to do. And then we waited a month and 2 months, 3 months for him to make his decision. And then in March of 11, I got this email from Andrew saying, you're not going to like this news at all, but David's decided to go with Penguin. And I don't think I've been sadder in my life as a publisher than that. And the book still hasn't happened. I think if he'd gone with us, it would have happened, but that's a different matter. Maybe it will emerge at some point. I don't know how much of it he'd actually created, but it would have been a very beautiful book.
Gosh. Hanif, you tell us more about the start of your collaboration with him. What did you do together?
Well, actually, we went to see David Bowie. Actually, with Alan,
yeah.
To talk to him about whether he would give us the rights to use some of his songs on a TV series I'd written called The Bitter Suburbia. Mostly about my life growing up in Bromley in the 70s, and Roger Michel was there.
He's the director.
And there was some sort of misunderstanding, and Bowie said, "Oh, I thought you were never going to ask me."
Yeah.
And I said, "What?" And he said, "To do the music for The Bitter of Suburbia."
So he had read it and knew about it before you got there. What?
Yeah. Yeah.
He was born quite near there. He was in Beckenham.
He was born
right?
in Brixton, but he'd lived in Bromley and Beckenham, and he played at the Three Towns.
Mm-hmm. So it was his story too.
Yeah,
in some ways.
But he was a bit older. Yeah. But he knew about all that, and so I hadn't thought, because he'd moved so far away for a moment, that he would be interested in revisiting all that or doing a soundtrack. And he'd never done a soundtrack before. He was going to do The Man Who Fell to Earth.
That's right.
But he was too knackered to do it after making the film. So then he said, can I do it? And so it was sort of terrible, really, because we had to go to... He was then living in Montreux in Switzerland, next door to Roger Moore.
What an unlikely couple.
And he was very bored. And he kept saying, it's terrible, because the only person who comes around to see me is Roger Moore, and he comes around every night. And it was very funny to imagine Roger Moore going around and knocking on David Bowie's door every night. And David said, Roger Moore just tells the same stories over and over again, and they're very beautiful. He said, but I can't bear it. I think I'm going mad. I need something to do. So I'm gonna do the soundtrack to The Bitter of Suburbia. Mm-hmm. So we'd go off to Montreux in Switzerland to see him. And we were drinking and stoned a lot in those days, and he was really straight. And it was really embarrassing, because we would run the film and then he would put the music and then we had to give him instructions. And we were really frightened. We were like schoolboys. We were really frightened, because it's really hard to say to David Bowie, you know, we'd go, well, you say it, you know, can you do that bit quicker, David? Because in this scene he's doing that. And, you know, can you do that bit a bit slower? Do you mind, you know? And it was really difficult to speak to the thin white Duke about how he should do his music. And then he did this incredible thing, because we were going back to London. He said, okay, I'll do it. And he stayed up. He said, I'm going to stay up all night, and then I'll come in. I'll see you at 10 o'clock in the morning. So we went out drinking, and he worked all night in his studio and redid all the music, did it quicker, where we said it should be quicker, and slower, where it should be slower. And I saw really what a committed and really hard-working person he was, that he really wanted to do this well, and he would do it over and over again until he did it, actually. And I could see that he was a very serious person.
And it worked, and it all happened?
Well, then he made a very good album called The Bitter of Suburbia that he recorded in that studio, which is a really good album. Bits of it we used, obviously, on the soundtrack. But then he kept saying, the BBC's paying me so little, I've got to make an album out of this. and he made that record and released it.
I commissioned that series, yes, of Bitter of Suburbia. And it was... The thing about Bowie is his curiosity fuels him. And every new... He's always looking for a new project, a new way in. So each thing is an adventure. And I think that curiosity that fueled him, and of course the other big collaborator with him was Brian Eno in Berlin, and that was this extraordinary transformation in Bowie's life. And you've got to remember also that he was in a city which at that stage, the Berlin Wall was still there. It was a divided city. And all those themes fueled him, plus, of course, the influences from around there. He immersed himself in electronic music. He found, and Brian Eno found him, and Brian, of course, has now been friends with him for, you know, nearly 40 years.
Yeah.
And that was an incredibly important period, that period in Berlin. You know.
But he managed to keep his last illness and the nearness of his death. Even Brian didn't know.
Brian didn't know he was sick.
No,
he didn't know he was that sick. I mean, interestingly enough, the people who did know were the people who, Robert Fox and people who were working on Lazarus, did know that he was that sick. But the notion that he should provide and choreograph his death,
yes,
and provide this gift to people. And I do remember, actually, just after his heart attack, him talking in an interview, actually on Radio 4, which I just heard recently, I hadn't heard it before, talking about this realization which comes to people at a certain age, probably some of you, but you're all too young out there, that actually it's not going to last, it's going to end.
Mm.
And I think that understanding that it was going to end, not that he was going to become decrepit, but that actually you have to keep doing things, that you haven't got much time left. And then sadly, obviously in the last few years of his life, you know, the heart attack had an impact on him. He had to keep quiet and calm. And then this resurrection, this sort of redemption with the next day and then Lazarus and the Black Star was extraordinary. It was his gift, you know.
Hay algo,
yes,
y haciendo referencia a lo que dice Alan, que me parece increíble, y es que en el mundo yo tuve la oportunidad de tener en mis manos la edición de la revista Mojo del mes de enero, donde salía una reseña muy amplia del álbum Black Star, donde se hablaba de un poco las motivaciones de David Bowie para llegar a este álbum, pero en ningún momento ninguno de los periodistas que reseña el álbum lee con detenimiento ese mensaje cifrado que estaba tanto en la letra de Black Star como en Lazarus, Look Up Here, I'm in heaven. Nadie lo entendió de la manera como él lo estaba dando. Y a mí me parece que en ese sentido David Bowie nos ha dado una gran lección, porque vivimos en un mundo tan absolutamente convulsionado de información que ni siquiera tuvimos el tiempo para analizar tanto el videoclip de Black Star como el videoclip de Lazarus, donde hay una referencia muy interesante a la etapa de Station to Station cuando él se va al armario y lo cierra. ¿Por qué David Bowie utiliza ese traje negro de esa etapa particularmente para dejarnos esa imagen, su última imagen con vida?
Yeah. Going on to other things with him, his influence on fashion, on style. I mean, he was unlike any other rock star, I think, that his influence was so wide. Where did you see that, Deborah, in terms of what you observed of the 70s and the 80s? That,
yeah, I mean, oh, just something that you said there. I mean, I don't know how you feel, but it's like David Bowie has died, but Ziggy Stardust is alive and haunts us all. And I don't know about the other personas. You know, we use this word persona, it sounds very grand, meaning it's the Greek word for the masks through which we speak. But when I was dancing to Bowie, I didn't really think about them as personas. This is the weird thing. I'd like, with 13, 14, I wasn't thinking to myself, oh, this is a persona. It was just Ziggy Stardust, and the Starman was going to come, and he was going to fly us away from the suburbs. And we would burn incense in milk bottles and listen to Rock and Roll Suicide and sort of want to live and want to die in the same moment. So there was this intensity so intense, really, with Bowie. And he was also a bit of a hysteric, which was great for a girl, because he had that kind of, you know, that tremble in his voice that you hadn't heard, I hadn't heard in rock or in before. So although she's another generation from me, someone like Janis Joplin, who really gave it out on stage and screamed, in a way, it wasn't so interesting to me as Bowie. Then the fashion thing, it wasn't just like a fashion thing. It was like a kind of a way of making your identity, saying, I'm not going to be that sort of girl. I'm not going to be that sort of woman. I'm not going to be that sort of man. So the boys at school who started to wear eyeshadow and eyeliner, and they were quite macho too. So there was a sort of new way of being in your body, of talking to each other, of experimenting with masculinities and femininities. And so in a way, it was kind of more interesting than fashion. But, excuse me, if you want my favorite fashion moment, it is Space Oddity, and it's his powder blue, really sharp trouser suit. And he shaved his eyebrows off and put on the blue eyeshadow. And all my friends used to shave off their eyebrows and then have to go creeping home, knowing they were going to get into big trouble.
I think what he did is he gave you permission
to
be anything
right.
you want to be.
Yeah,
you
know, no, I think that's really what he did. Important.
And people were desperate for that permission, you know. You could see it in those looks on people's faces when he performed. I know people always say this, a cliche of, you know, when you go to concerts. But actually, you know, they were allowed to inhabit this role and to interpret that role in any way they wanted. They were able to step on that, come on that flight with him, which he took, you know. It was extraordinary. And also, he is all, you know, like T.S. Eliot, the numbers of references that there are in his songs to things when you start to dig deep. And of course, he was also a big fan of William Burroughs and actually this cut-ups technique which he used, which he showed me. And at night, he would play around. He loved surrealism. He loved strange juxtapositions. That's the adventure of life, not taking things for granted, you know. And he never did. Not even death did he take for granted.
That cut-up thing, actually, I remember that because when he was writing the lyrics for The Buddha of Suburbia, he would tell me to collect words for him. So I would write down lists of words from the Buddha of Suburbia, and I would give him these lists, and then he would take them round his apartment, and he would cut them up with his, you know, William Burroughs' pair of scissors, and create this. And it was very crude. And then suddenly, out of this would come an amazing song, and it just seemed like magic to me that you could do that.
Jamie,
no, since he died, there have been a lot of things spoken of him and written about him, and one of the things that really I liked a lot was what Julian Temple, who's a filmmaker in the UK, made a number of very interesting films, and with Bowie, I think particularly collaborated on Absolute Beginners and some videos. And one of the things that Julian said, which I felt was just to kind of connect with a lot of what we've been talking about just now, is that we should remember Bowie as a great human emancipator on the Bolivar or Mandela scale, an emotional liberator of people. He was the patron saint of the outsider, the uninvited, the misfit, all those lonely teenagers in each generation unsure of who or what they could possibly be or become. Excellent. In other words, all of us. Mm-hmm. And I just...
I think it was a very accurate
summation of certainly why he's had not just a big impact on me in the past, and while he continues to, and kind of he also had such a beautiful, attractive, deviant, bad boy side to him, as well as being so beautiful to look at and having such a great voice. And I think, to me, the thing that continues to have such an impact is the way he kind of mined vulnerability in ourselves and the very complicated emotional things that goes through everyone's heads. And kind of one of the first tracks I really fell in love with was Rock and Roll Suicide. And my love of that song has changed over the years. And, you know, those lines, I've had my share, I'll help you with the pain, you're not alone. Kind of, to me, mean even more maybe now to me than when I first heard that song and heard Time Takes a Cigarette, puts in your mouth, you pull on a finger, you pull another finger, then cigarette, which to me, age 13, was just like the coolest lyric I could think of as someone who's just getting into smoking.
But it's still very cool.
Incluso, complementando lo que dice Jamie, All the Young Dudes es una canción fundamental para darle voz a esa juventud que necesitaba una voz que no la tenía, y sobre todo para apoyar a bandas jóvenes con mucho talento que no recibían la atención necesaria, como fue el caso de Mott the Hoople, que él fue fundamental en ese proceso.
The other interesting thing is
the Children Boogie.
He had this there's a paradox, of course, in Bowie, because although, you know, you could say a lot of performers and musicians, they love to show off, they love to go and say, do that. But there was something much more to it for him. It wasn't that. There was a purpose behind it, you know, in discovering and rediscovering and sharing that adventure with others. You know, it wasn't narcissism in any way at all. It was an exploration. And I think I always sense that about him, you know, that's what fueled him, you know. So as we say, when he came to the ability to see the world and to see your own place in that world change, and to find a way, to find a narrative and a story to tell and a character to deliver. I mean, look at Lazarus. Look at that song at the end, you know, and how brave and bold it is to do that, and to not do it in a way that's sentimental or whatever, but in an extraordinary manner.
I can't look at it actually. I've looked at it. I don't know about you. I've looked at it about three times. I can't process it yet. That film. I don't want to personally. I don't feel like I can look at its message to me. I know that there is one. I'm quite interested in the way that he placed a skull in the other film, inside the spacesuit. But I can't process it at all. That's something I'll be watching in 2 years' time.
Well, that sounds quite good to me.
I didn't watch it for the first week, and then I'm so glad I did, because it's incredibly beautiful and powerful, and like all his work, I think there's a great generosity I often feel at play within the work that I've always responded to, even at times it's dark and it's...
But it's a great generosity of taking you on a journey and not being afraid.
Yeah, and reminding
what I felt when I watched
giving
it.
You license to also reinvent yourself throughout your life. You don't have to be one thing. You can continue to play with all the things and shapes that are around there, both people and the ideas in your head. And he gives incredible license, and still does, even though he's gone. That license hasn't lessened.
Hay una frase que pronunció Leonard Cohen cuando le dieron el premio Príncipe de Asturias en el año 2011. Y él dijo, palabras más, palabras menos, en el momento que nos vamos a enfrentar ante la derrota, lo debemos hacer bajo los estrictos parámetros de la belleza. Creo que ese es el gran mensaje que nos ha dado David Bowie con esta manera de prácticamente morir en el escenario.
I want to mention one thing that some of you will see. I think I may have spoke to Jamie about it. I don't know if any of you saw the photograph which Iman took of him.
No, where was
it? 48 hours, or maybe less, before he died. It was amazing. It's him in a suit. You can get it if you go on to Google.
She took that, did she?
She took that picture.
Wow. Ah.
He looked amazing.
Yeah.
He looked so fit and so well. You know, it's the mystery of life and death.
Was that only 48 hours before he died?
Only 48 hours before he died.
Extraordinary.
Yeah. It's an amazing photograph. I mean, just amazing.
So before we opened up for people in the audience to come and ask questions or tell us things about him, Hanif, what do you think in 10 years' time, in 20 years' time, where do you think he'll be in our consciousness, in our lives?
I just think Bowie's going to get bigger and bigger, actually.
I was very amazed coming out from...
Doesn't everybody think that?
Walking out through Heathrow, through London Airport, 4 days ago, there's a huge picture of him coming through. Did anyone see it?
Yeah,
coming through Terminal 2.
Yeah.
And he's next to Charles and Diana getting married. And
yeah.
It's sort of put up with the equivalent sense of establishment, weirdly. I mean, he's as big in our firmament. Will he stay there? Will he get bigger? What will he do to a next generation?
My kids are listening to him. Their kids, I think. And there's a lot of music, actually, that he did, and a lot of quite obscure stuff and albums that people haven't listened to properly. It's a huge body of work.
It's an enormous body of work, yes.
Yeah.
But is it? It's also an enormous body of, who Alan's saying, giving you permission. People still need enormous amounts of permission to explore gender, explore androgyny. It's just as pressing today, more so in many ways.
It's also an interesting question about, I'd like to know whether people think it's really the end of rock and roll. I mean, when Bob Dylan dies, Paul McCartney, whether rock and roll has really exhausted itself, yeah. Whether rock and roll can ever, whether there can be another act for rock and roll. I don't know what people think about that. That in a sense it was invented in the 50s. And is there anything else to be said or anywhere that it can go now?
Well, it's not reinvented. I mean, he was the only one who kept reinventing himself because all the other rock and rollers go out and do the same thing. So it has, in a way, died.
Well,
quite
oddly enough, Bob Dylan is interesting in that sense. I just saw him at the Royal Albert Hall, and it was
how was it?
Well, it was interesting. The last time I saw him at the Roundhouse, he took all the songs you loved and did them his own way.
Screwed them up.
Spoiled them,
yeah.
All of them. This time he did something else. He was just having fun with his band, just doing whatever he wanted to do. And there was a kind of, you know, I'm here. I quite like having an audience around. I'm not going to look at them much. It was kind of like that. But in a sense, he was also kind of you know, he was just finding this pleasure in music that he had and in the kind of
but
music
he doesn't.
He liked.
He never has reinvented in the same way that
No, he hasn't. And obviously, you're right that whether it's Bowie or whether it's Mick Jagger or the Stones or the Who, they have a repertoire, and that's the repertoire they do, and they do it really well. Or Leonard
Cohen. No, that's
Coney,
not the case about that Dylan. Dylan has written some really great songs in the last 10 years, actually.
They're within a style, aren't they? It's not like he's doing something completely different. I mean, they're still wonderful, but they're wonderful in the same way. Okay.
Yeah, for me, it's just because if you look at the whole of Bowie's career, there's no question that what he did in the 70s as a decade was phenomenally productive. There's almost no single artist I can think of who in that decade produced
the changes
so different.
I think one of the other great things about him is he wrote truly brilliant dance music as well. I don't just mean by Let's Dance. I kind of think Fame and Sound of Vision and Suffragette City. I DJ quite a lot, and I love dropping Bowie on the dance floor, often with like heavy funky side of it, and people get off on it big time. But I don't know if it's the death of rock and roll. I've kind of close relationship with Nick Cave, who was a publisher. Nick, to me, is one of the people who's still around, who I love the way he's continuing to kind of grow as an artist. And as you saw him last on Monday, and hearing about his new record, which he's putting out in September, I think is going to really be another very interesting evolution for him. But I've never felt a sense of genuine bereavement with someone dying as I did when Bowie went. And there's no other... Dylan, I'll be really sad because I love Dylan's work too, but I don't have
not
the same thing there as I have with Bowie. But just back to Hanny's point about our children and stuff, I do think in the age we're living in, his music have a kind of timeless quality to them, which I'm already seeing in my younger kid who's getting more excited about Bowie than anything else I'm playing in. I'm playing a lot of good stuff, but
yeah.
Bowie, for some reason, he's just zoned in on that as there's something that's speaking to him as a six-year-old.
Coming back to this audience, just a second, Deborah, when you were speaking to that young girl, when she talked about her 14-year-old experience with such passion, and she was talking about Life on Mars and about what it did for her, this ability to... It's just like we can rediscover Dickens or Shakespeare or Tolstoy, whatever you want. The fact that this is there for people in a way that other music isn't quite... You know, he's very distinctive in that way. And that there are so many different experiences that you can have.
Yeah.
with this. With,
isn't with this it interesting, though, how avant-garde he was and how popular he was? I mean, how hard is it to do that?
Yeah.
To do really, really interesting music, great music. I mean, Miles Davis is a genius of music, but he was never a popular artist in the
way that
Bowie
was. Every generation will invent him. So, you know, that's the thing. He doesn't belong to my generation. We're talking about... I know he kind of chronologically in time sort of does, but because he's a great artist, every generation will claim him and make something of their own from him. So that girl that I was talking to, you know, she's so cool that she's made something of Bowie that I haven't made, and I could listen to her all night talk about Bowie. And my 16-year-old daughter, Layla, you know, if you think about her growing up, I don't know what it's like here, but the singers that she... So Taylor Swift and Rihanna, they're great, but they're very groomed, very, very, very different from my generation, which had punk and had songs like there was a woman in a band called Polystyrene, and she used to sing Bondage Up Yours.
That was my generation.
And the Slits and the Stranglers. So someone like Bowie, Layla has just invented her own story for Bowie. It's not my story, and that's why he's so great.
Okay, it's her story and history. That's brilliant.
Can we bring the lights up? Because we've got like literally 5 minutes, and there may be some people who want to just come in and.
We're never going to stop talking now. We started talking.
Well, I know
you're
never going to stop talking. But it just would be nice.
Play some of this music.
Okay. Is there anyone? Can we do the lights? Thank you. Is there anyone who'd like to ask Hanif or Alan or yes, lady here? We've got time for maybe two or three, if you can keep them. Have we got no microphone?
Can you use this one, Rob?
Yeah, give them up.
Oh. Jamie, thank you. I didn't realize they were all up here.
No, I just wanted to point out, not only in the music, but in the movies. All the things he did for aesthetics, for movies, the way he made roles like Furio, that for the first time made that two men, even being enemies, can be attracted for each other in the sense of pride of honor they did. Like all these characters that he invented in movies, I would like... I have been a rock freak all my life. But it was also in movies when he made me discover many other things. So I just would like you guys to comment a little bit about fashion and about movies and all this capacity. The hunger was something that really, really created a pretty deep impact on me and on all the things that he can conjugate with Bauhaus and with all this new perspective. Now pants are very much in fashion, but by the time he did The Hunger, he was always a visionary. So I would just like you guys to talk a bit about all these other places where he also had an invention. It was just a commentary about him as a, not only as a musician, but as all the other aspects of art that he did.
Okay, who wants to pick that up?
Well, I'll just say he was a performer, and he did, after The Man Who Fell to Earth, there were a number of productions he did. He was an artist, Bowie. I mean, he's actually given me a painting, which I'm still looking for, you know. But he was driven. He was all the arts interested in, whether it was poetry or literature or, you know,
theater.
He loved theater. He did. So, and I'm not sure whether he. I don't know. Other people can talk about him in the movies. The Man Who Fell to Earth. There was actually based on. That image you saw in the back of the car, particularly of him, which Nicholas Rogue saw, and he got in touch with me, and that's how he got cast in The Man Who Fell to Earth. But I think his place is,
you know, not necessarily on a screen in that way. It's in a different place, in a different space, really. But it really, he became a character, I think.
Incluso complementando lo que dice Allen, creo que el papel de David Bowie en Good Morning, Mr. Lawrence, y el corto papel que interpreta de Poncio Pilato en La Última Tentación de Cristo es bastante interesante. Yo creo que además Bowie a varios de los músicos que alrededor de él intentaban tener una carrera como actores, particularmente me refiero al caso de Mick Jagger, dejó una lección muy importante. Yo creo que Mick Jagger en el fondo intentaba de alguna manera equiparar todo eso que David Bowie había hecho. A David Bowie lo inspiró Syd Barrett con el tema del maquillaje, y Alice Cooper y Peter Gabriel, pero no los copió. Él dio forma, dio una nueva vida a ese personaje que iba creando. Y cuando veía que lo empezaban a seguir, él inmediatamente cambiaba para que no lo siguieran. Y ahí empieza uno a ver esa capacidad tan versátil de evolucionar que se puede apreciar perfectamente en las películas, especialmente en Good Morning, Mr. Lawrence, que es una gran interpretación de David Bowie.
The only thing I'd want to add is that to me it's all in that lyric, the gift of sound and vision. That's what he gave us, and he was always very interested in both and very aware of the relationship of the two together that they used in original ways. So sound and vision was what?
Anyone else?
I think sound and vision, that's an interesting thing. I mean, I think what we're talking about is someone who's not just a musician in that sense. I mean, I think that exhibition at the V&A, which was so exceptional, yeah, gave you a sense that Bowie makes you look at the world and see the potential and the possibilities out there, see even the dangers and the risks, but to be bold enough to go there and not to be afraid to steal either, or to embrace something and then discard it and move on to something else, but not in a negative way, but in a positive way. It makes you aware of the full potential the world has for you. I mean, that's the excitement of Bowie, and you can't say that. You can say that about early Dylan, you can say it about other things, but there are not that many musicians. He's beyond being just a musician, I think.
Is there anyone else who'd like to share anything? Yeah, lady there. And then we'll probably, they're waving at me from the audience.
We should talk a bit about him as a British artist. Something very British about that.
Yeah. He loved British art. He collected
the Stones, for huge instance, who I think of as an American R&B band.
Yeah. I thought they were American when I was a kid.
So. You're right, okay. Honey. If he
yes,
was very much,
hello.
Despite the fact he lived in
and
America.
Sang in a British accent, and yeah.
Anthony Newley, yes.
We should talk about that.
Yes, go on.
Yes, would you consider Lazarus to be his masterpiece, perhaps? Lazarus, his last play.
I wouldn't put it like that.
Final. I haven't seen it. Did you see it, Al?
Yeah, you mean the video, not the show.
Did you see the
show? You're talking about the show in New York, or
yes,
the album.
Yes, the off-Broadway play
I would not, having not seen it, I would still not consider it to be his masterpiece, because I think that's too easy for Bowie. I mean, there are too many. It's quite difficult for us to choose the ones we like or don't like. They're all about a different period, a different feeling.
His masterpiece, you could say, was his work. You know, his life. He created an incredible body of work.
To me, it's so unique was the variety of it and the quality over such a sustained period and the constant reinvention. You know, there's no one who holds a candle to him when you look at it in that context.
Do you think it's his masterpiece?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Why?
Definitely. Because I think he had the opportunity to say goodbye. And I think there's a lot of maturity and it's just amazing that the way he left the planet. I think it is absolutely his masterpiece.
Did you see the show on Broadway?
I have not. I saw clips of the show, and I just did a little clip of him in a radio show I have. So I went through a lot of his work, and I just got that feeling. I wanted to know your opinion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for the question.
People are going to carry on talking about Bowie, aren't they? More
forever.
More.
Yeah, I think it's true. And I like this feeling that every generation will reinvent him as their own. And that's very nice.
I hope they remount. Did anyone in the room here go to the V&A exhibition of Bowie's one there? A few. Because that was just the tip of the iceberg, I felt. Kind of. You could take
over be another one.
The whole of the Tate Modern and do a pretty special thing to...
Well, they probably will.
All right, listen, on that note, you're now going to be treated to a film, which was... Have you seen the film? Do you want to tell them a little about it?
This is a BBC film. It's called 5 Years. And it's very good, actually. It's a very good way of getting an understanding of these different periods in Bowie's life. And it takes 5 particular years. There's incredible access to archive, which a lot of which comes from the BBC, which was actually pulled out by a brilliant archivist. And I think it's very intelligent. You also get a very good insight with Carlos Alomar and Nile Rodgers.
Yeah.
When was it made, Alan?
It was made about 2 years ago. Okay. Yeah, that's it. And although it was at the time of the V&A exhibition, it all went on at that time. And Bowie, once again, at this point, he detached himself from things, so he would be supportive of it, but he didn't get involved. And I think you'll really enjoy it. I think it's a very interesting review of his life and his work.
Well, thank you all very much for coming, and would you all thank Hanif and Jamie and Deborah and Jacko and Alan as well.
Conversations like this are going on all over the world at this moment. You know, some of them.